Hi, everyone. This is Grayson Nicholson, the host of the Austin Peay Experience podcast. Welcome to the Austin Peay Extras, the podcast series where we share some of the fascinating talks and lectures hosted by the university each semester. In this episode, Dr. Mike Wilson shares what Bigfoot, ostrich eggs, and a local manhunt have in common. The talk comes from the March Science on Tap with Wilson's Myths, Mysteries, and Manhunts, hosted by the College of STEM. Enjoy.
All right. Welcome. My name is Karen Meisch. I'm the Dean of the College of STEM. Thank you so much for coming tonight. We're very excited that you're here. During spring break, of course, Dr. Wilson has been gracious enough to agree to give up some of his valuable time on spring break to come over here. So I appreciate everybody coming out to support the College of STEM and to learn more about myths, mysteries, and manhunts. It's going to be a very exciting talk. Dr. Mike Wilson is the director of the GIS Center here on campus, and it's one of, I think, our best kept secrets here at Austin Peay. A lot of people don't understand necessarily what GIS does, or even that we have a center that does a lot of really cool things and a lot of really great collaborations. So I think you'll find tonight's talk a lot of fun. Again, the purpose of Science on Tap is to try and have an opportunity to communicate what we find the fun part of science with the community. So I'm really glad that you guys are here. I hope that you'll join us next month. Our speaker is John Nicholson with a computer science and information systems, information technology department. Dr. Nicholson, sorry, right over there. And his talk on April 4th will be Generative AI, When Machines Dream of Electric Sheep. And if you haven't heard of ChatGPT, he will be talking quite a bit about ChatGPT, and his title was actually generated by ChatGPT. So it'll be a really neat talk on artificial intelligence, and I think really important about what's going on right now in our world with AI. So again, that will be on April 4th. If this is your first time or if you're joining us again or repeat customer, we'd just love to remind you to please fill out your comment cards. That's our way, of course, of getting ideas for our next speakers and trying to make sure that we're giving you, of course, the content that you desire. But also it's a great way to make sure that your name is in the drawing for our prize. So one of the books and one of the really cool things that Mike will be talking about is in our prize tonight, a book called Longitude, as well as a golden compass. And so it's not real gold, don't get too excited. But that will be for tonight. So without any further ado, Dr. Mike Wilson.
I want to thank everybody again for coming tonight. If you have any questions throughout my talk, feel free just to raise your hand and I'll try to answer as I'm talking. We'll see how that goes. Again, my name's Mike Wilson. I direct the GIS Center on campus. GIS Center, for those of you that don't know, has been in existence since 1998-99. And I've been the director since 2005. So what I'm going to talk today is myths, mysteries, and manhunts, and talk about various aspects of mapping and what GIS is. I'm going to start off with the idea of a brief history of maps, or where the heck am I? Maps, it's important to note, mankind wants to know where they're at. They want to quantify their environment. And maps are a great way to do that. And so I'm going to show you basically a roadmap of maps and adventure throughout history, ending with GIS and modern mapping. I'm going to start with the Imago Mundi, which my pronunciations are never going to be good, so I'll throw that out there. This is the oldest known map in existence. It's a Babylonian map that's approximately from the 8th century before the current era. Now what's interesting about this is this map, it's cuneiform with Babylon in the center, centered on the Euphrates River. What's also cool is if you flip it over on the back side, it actually has the constellations. And scientists have been able to map the constellations on this map to our modern constellations. And it actually tracks. That's pretty interesting. Now, most of these early maps I'm going to show you are more, I guess, towards, particularly this one, religious aspects, as opposed to being accurate for the face of the Earth. I'm going to show, here's one of the other early maps from Greek philosopher, again, from before the current era. What's interesting about this is this philosopher created the idea of longitude and the idea of using longitude, basically lines that go north to south on the Earth to mark your location. Also with this, it sort of shows the idea that the Earth is round. It's important to note this because this was lost in the Middle Ages, where the Earth was considered flat. And that's more of a biblical outlook for the Earth. Again, flat as opposed to a globe. This other cool map I have is Ptolemy's Mediterranean map. And if you look at it, it's a map of Spain all the way over to India. Now, what's cool about this is this is the first map that was actually drawn with a projection. And so if you look at it, the relative size, the items on the map are sort of relative. You'll notice the curved way it's drawn. And so again, the representation, he's showing a projection where trying to get more accurate with these maps. And again, this was something that was lost through particularly medieval Europe. Now, what's also interesting, particularly about this philosopher, is his book, which translates the word geography, is still in existence today, and his translations have come forward through time. So again, we have maps and information coming through from approximately 1,700 years ago. Now, I promised to bring a couple maps that had mythical creatures on it. I'm going to jump out here and see if I can show a zoomed-in copy of this map. There's the idea, here be dragons, which is traditionally, people have probably heard it, it's on maps. Turns out in history, there's really only two good examples of that being on a historic map. One of them's this map from, I think, the 13th century. You'll notice at the bottom, there's some dragons. Now, this goes to the idea that the Earth was flat. This is what's called a Psalter map. It's a map that was actually in a book of Psalms. So it's very biblically based. You'll see there's mythical animals around it. The idea of here be dragons, again, is not very common on historic maps, but usually maps did have fictional creatures or creatures you wouldn't normally see, such as here be lions or here be elephants would be something you would see in a European map. But again, this one's pretty cool because of the dragons. And I'm going to switch out and show this other one. And again, I promised to show some maps with dragons. This one, you can't see the dragons on it. It's from the 1600s. But what's interesting is it's a globe from the 1600s that's made out of ostrich eggs. And somehow, again, this survived through time. So this is from the 1600s, and it's two halves of an ostrich egg glued together. And somehow, again, this has survived all those years and was sold to Sotheby's. Now, if I remember correctly, the New World is represented as two small islands on the other side of the globe. So the New World, North and South America, again, are two small islands. Let me go back over here. Now, I mentioned briefly the idea of longitude. And this is where one of the cool stories in map history, at least in my mind. Now, I put on here death and dead reckoning. What does that mean? Before they could calculate longitude, they could calculate latitude, where you were from the equator, based on the position of the sun. They couldn't accurately find longitude. And so what that meant was sailors up until the mid-1800s basically had to say, okay, I'm going to sail that way 2,000 miles, and hopefully I'll hit the port I'm looking for. At least something I recognize, and if not, we're in trouble. And so what happened was, particularly again before, 1750, was that that a lot of ships were lost, hit reefs, all sorts of misfortune, because they were using dead reckoning. The idea of say, okay, go that way 1,000 miles and I'll hit my port. Now, going back to our early philosophers, they first talked about the idea of longitude over 2,000 years ago. The problem wasn't solved till about the 1770s, right before the American Revolution. And it's an interesting story. Now, I'll take that early philosopher's map, and if I throw his map over a modern map of Europe, it actually starts to look really, really good. And it fits. And that was about the best they had up until, again, the 1770s. What happened was in 1714, the English merchants approached the English government and said, this is messed up. We keep losing ships. We're losing money. And English Parliament created what's called the Longitude Act and created a huge prize, which today would equate, I think it was 20,000 pounds in the 1770s. It would equate to multi-million dollar today. And said anybody that could solve this problem within, I think, approximately 4 minutes hour, maybe a little bit more, between 4 and 8 minutes hour, would get the prize. And lots of people tried over time to do that. It came down to there was two main methods you could track longitude, at least was the prevailing theory as of the mid-1770s. It was either use lunar reckoning, so you had to have a clear sky, you had to see the moon, and then you had to do a whole bunch of complex calculations, and you could figure out your longitude, not necessarily to the degree to get the prize. Or the other theory was to be able to tell time. Think about the globe for a second, and the globe is 360 degrees. If you divide 360 by 24 hours, that equals 15 degrees. 1 hour equals 15 degrees. So if I knew the time at point A, which in this case, Greenwich, England, which is the prime meridian, if I knew the time there and knew the time where I was at, I could do a whole bunch of math. And I told Karen I'd wiggle my fingers because I'm not going to try to explain the equations. I could do some math that really wasn't that difficult. If I had a paper and pencil and my notes, I could do it here. You could actually calculate where you're at. The problem was the clocks at the time were pendulum clocks, those old grandfather clocks you sometimes see. And putting those on a ship with waves didn't work out too well. Up until a man named John Harrison, who was a carpenter by trade, he designed and had the idea for a very accurate clock. And he basically went through five iterations, till he hit on something that was good enough. His clock could keep time, and it actually looked like a pocket watch, which again, at the time, wasn't considered very accurate, and that was part of his problem, I think, just the look of the clock. He could keep time. Over 81 days, the clock lost 3 minutes, 36 seconds, which is amazing accuracy considering it was, again, 1760. And his son, in order to get the prize, they said, you have to travel to Barbados from England. And his son said, Dad, you're too old. I'll do it for you. And on the way, we'll also check the lunar method, compare. They sailed to Barbados, and using the clock, they were able to get within 10 miles of Barbados sailing from England, which again was unheard of. So, and the lunar calculations got them close, but not as good as the clock. The captain of the ship decided to buy the clock right then and there. They sailed back to England, and the English government said, it was a fluke, we're not giving you the money. So they said, let's sail again. They sail again. It was a fluke, we're not giving you the money. And so John Harrison wasn't going to get his money, so he approached King George III. King George III thought, well, this is pretty interesting. Harrison gave him H5, his fifth version of the clock, so the king kept the clock at the palace, I guess, and kept track for 90 days, and he lost even less than 3 minutes over that time. And the king said, go to Parliament, they'll give you your money. And of course, Parliament said, no, we're not giving you your money. They gave him most of the money, and Harrison wound up living comfortably his whole life. And what's ironic here is the English government never did pay that money out. They kept using the clock. Over time, that became the timekeeping method is the way to go with this. And we used up until GPS. And even up to modern times, they use Morse code and radio signals. They'd radio the times from Greenwich, and then you could calculate where you're at based on your current time. Now, I'm just going to point out with the Longitude Act, just an interesting fact. The English government still has it, and they use the Longitude Act for any of their, I guess, moonshot type projects. Right now, the Longitude Act, or Longitude Prize, I should say, is for something to do with penicillin and antibiotics. I didn't read all into it, but every couple of years, when somebody wins the prize, they come up with another moonshot idea and people try for it. But the whole idea of this clock is pretty interesting. And I'm also going to point out, I'm pretty sure this particular sample of the watch there is the one that was on the Bounty from, if anybody here familiar with Mutiny on the Bounty? Old movie? Good, at least somebody is. That's the actual clock from the Bounty. I think Mr. Christian, when he mutinied, kept the clock. The clock was on Pitcairn, and it was recovered, I think, 100 years later and shipped off to the British Museum. So that's the actual clock that was on the Bounty when that mutiny occurred. Now, I'm going to switch to a new era where maps are used for basically war and pestilence. I want to use a local example, which we find interesting. The US government during the Revolution couldn't afford to pay its troops and didn't have the resources, couldn't figure out what to do. Then they decided, hey, the one thing we do have is land. So they started giving land grants to soldiers in Middle Tennessee, Kentucky, through Alabama. There's approximately 15,000 parcels of land that were given out to soldiers. And we're working right now with the Southern Grassland Initiative to map all these historic land grants. And what's pretty cool about this, again, these land grants were granted. They had surveyors traveled from the East Coast out to survey it all. And we have those historic records and deed descriptions. Based on those deed descriptions, and I'll jump out here. As I mentioned, we're working with the Southern Grasslands Initiative and mapping all those parcels. If you see these points on the map, I'm going to try zooming in. Each of these points, now of course I zoomed in too far. Each of these points on the map represents a corner of a piece of land. And if I can actually click on this, there we go. What we're capturing is what the corner was composed of. And why is this interesting? Well, for the Southern Grassland Initiative, Let me try clicking on another point here. Okay, here's one. For the Southern Grassland Initiative, we're capturing what was the corner of that lot. They're interested in historic grasslands. So what we're capturing, in some cases, these descriptions say barrows. Barrows is a 1700, 1800 slang for a grassland, so we can tell where there's grasslands. Also, we're capturing what kind of tree, if they used a tree as the corner. And I'm a data person. I couldn't identify a maple tree with a Canadian flag in front of me. So don't ask me any questions about that. But based on the type of tree, Dwayne Estes and his group can look at that and say, this is the type of tree that was on the edge of a grassland. So what we're doing is tying together Revolutionary War data with our modern interests. Now, I'm also going to point out, I have a personal interest in these maps. My wife had watched Hamilton at least 1,000 times. I've never watched the whole thing, but yet I can sing the songs off key and quote every word because I've walked into the living room and seen enough pieces. Ironically, Hamilton, one of the reasons people didn't like him was land speculators bought a lot of this land from the soldiers. And Hamilton, based on our current economics, said, we can't force the speculators to give back the land to the soldiers, because there was a big push to do that. A lot of people got upset with him, but that's the basis for modern land ownership in the US. Once you sell land, the previous owner can't come and say, no, I made a mistake. I didn't charge you enough. Let me claw it back. So again, these maps tie into my love-hate relationship with the musical Hamilton, the Revolution, and SGI. So I'm going to switch back. Now, okay, I have a quote here from John Snow to Henry Whitehead. I'll let you read this quote, and I want to explain who this is. John Snow is the father of modern GIS, also the father of epidemiology. And Henry Whitehead, at one point, he's a minister, but he's also a minister that initially hated John Snow, and they became fast friends. What they're talking about is in the 1850s, cholera was believed to be spread by miasma. Miasma is bad smells in the air. So if there was a bad smell in the air, you could get cholera. And in reality, it's a waterborne disease. At the time, hundreds of thousands of people could die from it. In fact, I believe in India, in a 60-year period during this time, it's estimated 15 million people died from cholera. Even today, between 21 to 145,000 people die of cholera a year. Cholera is awful. Cholera is because of contaminated water, basically poop in the water. So it's important to know that. And what happened was John Snow lived in the Soho neighborhood of London. It was a smelly neighborhood. But apparently, all of London at the time was smelly and awful. So we're just going to put a pin in that and say everywhere stunk in London at that time. They started a cholera outbreak in London at the time. John Snow, being a doctor, said his radical theory was this is a waterborne illness. It's not miasma. Miasma is sort of like you have a fire and there's smoke. The smells and all are a symptom as opposed to the actual disease. And what he did was, since they had this outbreak in his neighborhood, he handled this like a modern data scientist. And first thing he did was he started interviewing people that were sick. And if you look really closely at the map, and let me switch over to a digital copy. And I'm going to try to zoom in here. you look and there's these little lines on the map. Let me back out. There. Each one of these little black lines on the map represented death. Represented death from cholera. And so John Snow went throughout the neighborhood, interviewed people. Now he did have some outliers, and most of the deaths he tracked down had to do with that water pump right here. So, and most of the deaths were coming from this house here. And if you look, it's right next to the water pump. So he started thinking, okay, this disease is happening from the water pump. Now, in this outbreak, he had people that miles away died. And he couldn't quite figure out how those fit. But he said, okay, I believe it's the water is the problem. Now also, I'm going to zoom out a little bit. And there's a workhouse right here, which has very few deaths in it. And then there's a brewery somewhere on here, which has very few deaths. People said, no, we'd have a lot of deaths at the workhouse if it was the pump. Well, it turns out the workhouse had its own water. So it didn't come from there. It also turned out that the brewery, the brewmaster said, oh, all my people drink alcohol all day long. And we have our own pump. But they drink alcohol all day long, which I thought, well, that's a heck of a job. You get to test the wares. So in that paper map, he found most of the deaths circled around that pump. And he went to the local officials and said, we need to do something about this. The local official said, nah, it's miasma. But just to humor you, we'll take the well pump handle. We don't believe this is water-based. It's because it's really smelly is the problem. Well, turns out soon as they took the water pump, the disease dried up and went away. So I think there was only a couple hundred deaths from this outbreak, as opposed to the thousands or tens of thousands, which were common in London at the time. Now, I mentioned Pastor Whitehead as being his enemy. Whitehead believed that cholera was because of divine intervention, not water. And he went to prove Snow wrong. Well, it turned out what he found was he started interviewing the people that were miles away and died. Well, it turns out one household, the mother liked the taste of the water from that well, and every day she had somebody, or every couple days, had somebody bring her a jug of water from that well. Most of the other deaths, the kids went to school near that area or passed by that pump on the way home. They grabbed water and took it home with them. And so it turned out Whitehead found everybody he interviewed was tied to that pump. Then that house that was the worst, he actually went and visited. It turned out that patient zero was a baby that, interestingly enough, didn't die. And the mother was washing the diapers and throwing the water into the cesspit, which was basically the basement. So they're filling up the basement with sewage, which was 3 feet from the well. And they actually found cracks in the wall when they dried things out that went to the well. So there was your source of the infection. So the pastor wound up proving Snow's theory. And on top of that, they became lifelong friends. Now, I'm showing a modern GIS map as this heat map on top of this, on top of John Snow's map. And what's interesting is if you look at this, and I'm going to try zooming out a little bit, the hot spot is right there in the middle. So this is a modern interpretation of this data that was done in 1750. And you'll notice that the modern data is showing that hotspot exactly, and it fit. So again, this John Snow's map is considered the first modern use of data and maps to prove a point. And again, this one's, if you have a chance to read the story, it's really interesting. But it was all solved by removing the pump handle. And I think eventually they wound up replumbing that well. And I think the pump is still there today, with a memorial on it, and there's a bar right across the way with Snow's name on it, because again, let's have a bar, and water with alcohol in it is much better for you than just plain water in London. So let's switch back. But if you have a chance to ever read about John Snow, it's really a fascinating story. And I'm going to switch from that now into modern mapping, modern GIS, sort of what I do. And I want to start with the idea of what data costs. In 1980, a gigabyte of space cost $700,000. Cloud-wise, right now, and the price hasn't changed in 2023, it costs about 2 cents per gigabyte. What does that mean? That means companies no longer have to delete anything. Everything is saved. We are capturing data left and right. Tools are needed to analyze that data. Just to give you a sense of perspective, 2 cents is me filling up the back of a pickup truck with paper. That's how much information that is. You look at these prices through here, 10 terabytes is enough for me to store everything I look at for a year, including health monitors, mouse clicks, and all that, and I can store that for $300. So it's important, as we talk about these next topics, to understand the cost of storage is so cheap that everything now is being stored. And this, again, is why GIS and mapping is so important. Now, I could give you a definition of GIS, and I'm not going to bore you with something that's really long and scientific-y. We're going to go with the idea location, location, location. And the second idea, that scientists estimate 80% of all information in the world has a location component to it. If I was to map out where everybody's sitting in this room, I'm willing to bet I can make some assumptions pretty quickly about relationships around tables. Because nobody here is sitting random. At least I, probably not. Most people are not. But again, I can make some assumptions just by taking the data in this room and plotting it out and taking a look at it. Now, really what GIS is, the idea of pictures worth a thousand words. It's taking large amounts of data and putting it something so somebody can make a decision just by glancing at a picture. So that's mostly what I do. Good example, I have 3,500 records of sightings of Bigfoot. You look, this is all tabular data. It's a spreadsheet. What assumptions can I make from this data? Well, it's really hard to tell. I'm not sure. I'll be honest, I have no sense of direction. I can't look at a coordinate and say, oh, that's where that is in the Earth's surface. I can't do any of that. That's why I got into maps, because I get lost constantly. So, but if I take that data and start plotting it on the map, I can start seeing all sorts of things. And I'll switch over to my digital again. So I have Bigfoot locations plotted on a map. Again, I can make some assumptions. This one is a really cool representation because it's a dashboard that includes Bigfoot sightings on the left, weather on the right top corner, and then also natural disasters on the bottom. And so it's using a dashboard to display this data. Now, if I go in here, and I'm going to try clicking on some of these. And I'll probably have picked the wrong one. I've just clicked on a point about Bigfoot. And if I scroll through here, it's actually given me, I have the report of what they found. Oh, about 7 to 8 feet tall, standing upright, facing us. It was not moving. I have other ones here. And of course, I'm not going to be able to find those right off the bat. Let me try this one. Some of these actually have pictures attached and also audio recordings so I could tell you what Bigfoot sounded like. And of course, since I'm here, I'm not going to be able to find them right off the bat. But afterwards, if you want to see, we can start looking at pictures of Bigfoot and all that. But it's the idea that spreadsheet didn't tell me much. But if I look at the data, I can see a picture and the importance of that. So that, long and the short, is what GIS is. Now, just other cool ways we can display this data, let's look at Dracula real quick. And this is what's called the story map somebody's created. And if I start scrolling through here, I can actually, with the data, start telling a story of Dracula, the historic figure, Vlad the Impaler. And the map's not showing up, so bear with me. Okay, the map's not gonna show up right this second, but I can sit here and show a map, location, the history, and all that, pull it together so I can tell a story and show something really in detail. So again, it's sort of dry talking about Dracula, but if I can show those pictures, show that story, I can draw people in and explain things. And again, I apologize about my internet here. So let's switch over. Now, I'm going to switch over to what I do day to day, what the GIS Center does. And I'm going to start by talking about Kirby Wallace for a second. Kirby Wallace was a murderer probably 3 or 4 years ago who was running around in the woods in Stewart County. He would pop out of the woods, do something horrible, and then go back into the woods. If you're familiar with that area of the country over in Stewart County, it's super thick, you can't see anything. So what did we do? Well, we flew drones. One of our drones gave its life trying to find Kirby Wallace. We didn't crash the drone. A sheriff's deputy ran it over. Karen helped us take care of that, but a sheriff's deputy ran over the drone on the ground. We created all sorts of maps. Those maps were used directly to find Kirby Wallace. We helped create maps with where they had roadblocks, where they had already searched, what they were looking for, and again, use those maps. Now, I also included a bunch of headlines up here to show some of the other cool stuff we've done over time. And a lot of this stuff is more historic. And I want to go over, and I want to show something modern. Now, I'm hoping my internet's good enough for this. Yes, okay, good. Last year in August, there was major flash flooding in the city of Waverly in Humphreys County. The day of the flood, the GIS Center went down there with the invite from EMA, and we flew search and rescue with our drones. After search and rescue was accomplished, we then set them up and worked with them to do the damage assessments. So what did that mean? We set up maps and mobile applications so the first responders could go out, quickly and easily collect damage assessment information. That information was then given to the state and FEMA to get the citizens the help they needed as quickly as possible. Now, most people, or a lot of people, don't know the scale of the disaster in Waverly. 1 week after the flood in Waverly, there was a hurricane and all the news media switched to that. What's horrible about Waverly, 121 people lost their lives. But also, if you look at the top here, destroyed and major. In a flood event, anything with major damage needs to be torn down. So what we have is approximately 570 residents that needed to be torn down. That represents approximately 30% of all the residential structures in the city of Waverly. So 30% of those structures needed to be torn down. Were they torn down? Probably not. Why not? because most of the people that were affected were the poorest citizens. Also, if they're like me, they have a mortgage, which means unless somebody's paying off my mortgage, I'm stuck at that property. What I suspect will happen in Waverly is over the coming years, we'll see outbreaks of breathing disorders, mainly from mold and flood-related bacteria. And a lot of that has to do with the poorest citizens were affected, they were in the floodway, and additionally, poor citizens have the most trouble recovering or getting their money back out of the property. Now, FEMA does give aid, but it's never enough. So it's something to keep in mind of flood disasters. Flood disasters, most people that die during a flood are in their cars. They try to drive across water. The real damage from most flooding is after the fact with disease, mold, and all that good stuff. But I just wanted to point this out about Waverly and what they went through down there. And then again, I had the honor, or the GIS Center had the honor of trying to assist. And I believe we did, because in most cases, the data was used directly to get aid to these people as soon as possible. So I'm just going to stay with my web map here. I have a more pleasant project we worked on, and I'm going to switch over to Mount Olive Cemetery. For those of you that are not familiar, Mount Olive is a cemetery in the south of Montgomery County. It's a predominantly African-American cemetery, active from, I believe, 1817 to the 1950s. There are a number of African-American veterans buried there, including Civil War soldiers all the way through, I think, to World War I. The cemetery was overgrown, was basically trashed, and the Historical Society, Preservation Society, did an incredible job cleaning the place up. And we had the honor of working with them. One of our students went out and collected all the graves for the veterans. And I'm going to hopefully this will show up. So we created a story map that they're sharing with the public that on the left has all the information about Mount Olive. So there's 30 known colored troops. And I think there's actually more now. They've discovered a couple more in the records. And what we've done is created a bunch of interactive maps that can be shared with school children to share about the place. But then we've also mapped out where all these soldiers are. And if we click on their grave marker, it then brings up the biography of the soldiers. And again, the idea here is to share and educate the public about Mount Olive. I believe it's now on the historic registry. If there's anybody from Mount Olive here, I apologize that I didn't look that up ahead of time. But we've gone through, and one of our students went through and mapped all this, put the data together, and our students even today are still updating it. We just got notification they identified another soldier that was buried there. Approximately, I think, 1,500 people are buried in the cemetery. It was a slave cemetery. Many of the graves are unmarked. If we have any luck with grants this year, we're hoping to obtain a ground-penetrating radar and work with the Mount Olive Historical Society and basically do an underground survey of the entire area. I'm also going to point out a couple other interesting things with Mount Olive. Right now, I'm partnering with Health and Human Performance. They have students that are interested in the health of marginalized communities. And then we're working with them from the data standpoint, but their students are interested, again, more in the health perspective. So this is an interesting fusion of two different disciplines working together for the public good. So that's, I guess, Mount Olive. And let me switch back over. I think I have one or two more slides. Okay. Well, I forgot to add that last slide. I put a cartoon, didn't type the rest. I had phone calls today, I apologize. What that slide was gonna say, I'll go back to it. I'm a little embarrassed that I didn't have time to put it on there, but I thought the cartoon was funny. That's what it took me a while to find that. What I wanted to point out was what the GIS Center does, as I mentioned, is we're taking data and information with our partners and plotting that information, making that picture. All of you, probably most of you live here in Montgomery County. If you live in Montgomery County and you dial 911, the data that gets 911 to your call as soon as possible is all managed by the GIS Center. If you live in Cheatham County, same thing. We're managing the data working with our partners at 911 to make sure that data is being used to, again, help our fellow citizens in our community. So that's just some of the projects we're working on. I'm going to mention that at this point, we work with almost anyone, anybody. All you have to be is interested. I no longer care about majors. I no longer care about majors. What I care about is interest. And that's with faculty, staff, or students. We work with anybody to help them as best we can and make sure they have the information they need to make sound decisions without doing any judgments. So we try to keep everything as on the level as possible. And that's one of the reasons why most of our clients work with us. Does anybody have any questions? Yes.
Is that on Cumberland Drive now?
You would ask me that. I can't tell you exactly.
It is.
It is. Thank you. Thank you. I don't live here in Montgomery County, although I've worked here since 2005. And again, sense of direction, not good. That's why I'm into maps. Now, I think I had another question back here.
So all you guys have run the one that does the property lines and all that?
Okay, the property lines are all done by the property assessor, but we do work with them and use that data. Yeah, it's on the website. It's also used for a lot of other data products, particularly 911 uses those parcels extensively to determine.
You got like 2014, 16 different
years. Yeah, what we have on our website, for those of you not familiar, is we have numerous years of aerial photography. And it's really interesting if you take a look at Montgomery County. If you look out at exit 1, in 1998, it's all beautiful trees. And if you look at it in 2021, it's all houses. Now what's interesting about that is we're working with the school system. We use that data a lot. And I've helped various grades, the school system, use that type of data for various school lessons. Well, we do, again, it's all sorts of neat stuff out there. Any other questions? Yes. Yes, we have two open houses a year now. One on that event we all know as GIS Day in November. All of us have it on our calendars and keep it close to our hearts. I can't tell, it's middle of November, but we're also doing another open house on April 28th. April 28th, we'll probably be doing some technology demos, and I'll have students showing off some stuff, including our staff, showing how to collect data, other things you can do with information. For anybody that doesn't know, we also have a small maker space at the GIS Center, and we have all sorts of interesting technology. You're more than welcome anytime to come down, but we are having an open house on the 28th of April. Any other questions? Well, again, I appreciate everybody's time. Thank you so much.